situation over 5,000 miles away. But every time the U.S. kills an Al-Qaeda leader, what happens is that no one before the body is called. You do it a million times, and they never get it because the real solution always eludes them. That is, do nothing. Nada. If you want to shut down a fundamentally flawed system, all you gotta do is step out of its way, and it'll shut itself down. Nature has a way of correcting itself.
White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is White Aryan Resistance. Terrible Tommy right here in the bunker right here in North Central Indiana, Warsaw, Indiana, P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your donations for the show and other causes that you'd like to support. And it's a beautiful day here in the Midwest. It's August the 21st, Freya's Day. This is Ladies' Day in the bunker. That's right. And it warmed up. It was getting pretty chilly yesterday. Well, I'm going to read you something today. It's a little long, but I think it's something you need to spread around, which one of our associates sent us last night. It has to do with the farm-by-farm fight between China and the United States to dominate the global food supply. Actually, it has to do with China is not able to feed its own people and definitely cannot raise enough corn, and so they've sent their agents here in the Midwest and around the country to steal material, seeds, and so forth to take back to China. So it has to do with 2 to 5 million bushels corn, and 94% of the corn that China imports comes from the United States. Now, the thing that upsets me about this is that American farmers are so hungry that they'll sell to anybody. And in some ways, you can't blame them, but the more you plant in the land and take the nutrients out of the land, you'll gradually wear it out, plus the fact that they're putting tons of toxic fertilizers on the land just to raise massive amounts of corn to be shipped out to China and other places around the world. I don't think that bodes very well for our agricultural future, because each country is responsible for protecting its agriculture. It's probably the most important thing that they've got. And so we'll go on with this reading. On September the 30th, 2012, agents from the FBI contacted U.S. Customs and Border Protection at O'Hare International Airport in Chicago with an urgent request. They wanted bags from two passengers on an outbound flight to Beijing pulled from immediate inspection. The passengers didn't track as dangerous criminals. Lai Xiaoming, president of the Beijing King's Naur Seed Science and Technology, a large Chinese agricultural company that develops corn, rice, cotton, and other canola seeds, and Yi Jian, the company's crop research manager. In Li's luggage, agents found two large Pop Weaver microwave popcorn boxes. Buried under the bags of unpopped snack kernels were roughly 300 tiny manila envelopes, all cryptically numbered 2155, 2403, 2362. Inside each package was a single corn seed. In Yi's luggage, agents found more corn seeds hidden amid his clothes, each one individually wrapped in napkins from a Subway restaurant. Customs officers were dispatched to the gate area of the Beijing flight, where they found the two men and conducted body searches. Still more corn seeds, also folded into napkins, were discovered in Yi's pockets. Meanwhile, at a different gate, Wang Hongwei, another Chinese national believed to be employed by the King's Nower Company, agents never learned if he worked for the company or was related to someone who did, boarded a separate flight from Burlington, Vermont, where he had a car waiting for him to drive to Canada. FBI agents were there to follow him, though Wang, after leaving the airport parking garage, made a series of abrupt turns and managed to give his surveillance team the slip. It didn't matter. Border Patrol officers were waiting when Wang pulled up to the Highgate Springs port of entry along the Canadian border. He was selected out of a search, which turned up 44 bags of corn seeds under his seat and in his suitcases, as well as notebooks, a notebook filled with the GPS coordinates and digital camera containing hundreds of pictures of cornfields. Questioned by agents, Wang would say only that he had purchased the seeds from a man named Mo Halang, the director of international business at the Beijing Dea Bingnong Technical Group, DBN, the parent company of King's Nower Seed Company. Not wanting to alert Mo, agents allowed all three men to leave the country, but their corn seeds were confiscated. Special Agent Mark E. Benton, a 16-year veteran of the FBI, specializing in investigation of intellectual property theft, had the seeds sent to an independent biodiagnostic testing laboratory, which confirmed that they were proper proprietary genetically modified hybrids. Eventually, their genetic sequencing was matched to seeds under the development by our good friend Monsanto, and DuPont Pioneer and LG Seeds, which including LG's parent company, Grupa Limagrain, comprises three of the four largest seed companies in the world. The GPS coordinates were found to correspond with farms in Iowa, Illinois, where those companies were testing performance of new hybrids. What we've got here is corporate espionage, one corporation against other corporations. Now they're going to try to disguise it as a nationalist thing. But in reality, it's more about money. However, if these genetically bred corn seeds that Monsanto's putting out, if they're going to plant it all over to China, maybe, if some people are right, maybe that's going to poison the Chinese people and they'll have a lot more deaths over in China. But we don't know for sure about that. In this particular case, I see the FBI doing a pretty good job, even though they are more in tune with defending the intellectual property rights of Monsanto and these other big outfits rather than the common man. In December 2013, after collecting this evidence, U.S. Marshals arrived at Mo's home in Boca Raton, Florida. That's an upscale town. He was taken into custody and extradited to Iowa, where he has been under house arrest in Des Moines ever since. The FBI also brought charges against five alleged co-conspirators, all Chinese, who remain at large, including the three men stopped by custom agents, and eventually against Mo's sister, Mo Yun, as well. Mo and his sister are scheduled to stand trial before a federal court in Iowa in September on charges of conspiracy to steal trade secrets. If convicted, they face up to 10 years in prison and $5 million fine. You want to bet that that doesn't happen? Now, they can say all the property rights they want, but in reality, it is the possession of the farmers of America from where the seed derived. If they've taken the seed and changed it, should not be the situation. It's about stealing the grain of the American farmer. Well, I'm not going to read all this. It's a giant, long article. And it's primarily, oh my God, our patented seed is being ripped off by the Chinese. See, back in the old days, every farmer had seed corn. Many times he made his own seed corn. I remember sitting on one of these, like a bicycle seat, and turning a crank and shelling corn, and a lot of it was for seed. A lot of it was for the chickens, too. And that was in the old days, and then when the farmer got ready to plant his corn, if he didn't have enough seed corn, he'd go down to the feed store and buy seed that was not patented or anything. It was a gift from the gods. So enters Monsanto, one of the most vicious sons of bitchin' companies in the world, if not the most, as far as agriculture is concerned. They're screwing up societies all over the world by making these people in the third world buy this bullshit that they put out and patented. They can't afford it, so they lose their farms and everything else. So then what do? They go into the city and start it all over, being exploited by American capitalist corporations for manufacturing. So, and then pretty soon they can't hardly make it in the city either. So that's the way that goes. But in the old days, of course, I guess the Chinese could have come over here and bought all the seed corn they wanted, because it was everywhere. There's no shortage of anything like that. But now, not only does the big seed companies like Monsanto have the whole American population by the balls, and it starts at the farmer to where they have actual, like, Monsanto police that go around farm to farm, make sure that they're doing the right thing with their seed, which is patented and copyrighted. So what's going on here is a big blow up, because the Chinese government and their spies and agents are trying to rip off Monsanto and their ha-ha corn. So anyhow, that's the way that works. It's interesting that the United States provides 94% of the corn to China. That's interesting, because it sounds to me like capitalist corporations have the Chinese by the balls. They're desperate for food. They're going all over the place buying up land to plant and raise food. South America, Africa, every place. So here again, the predatory corporations involved in all kinds of stuff just go around fucking up everything in the world just to make lots of money. Gotta make lots of money. I hope you understand. I'm trying to lay it out for you in basic, straight terms. That's all they do. They chase the dollar. They chase the profit. They invest, like I said yesterday, they invest in a country when the country has a lot of credit, a lot of money. They printed a lot of money. They get in there and invest. The minute it turns sour a little bit or dips down beyond a certain percentage, they're gone, thus throwing the country into panic and bad times, people marching and screaming in the streets. But the trouble is, they don't carry out the screaming in the streets enough to where they can attack the system. It reminds me of these right-wingers in London and the left-wingers in London. The racist whites and the anti-racist whites out there rolling around in the gutter in the street fighting. When I have told both sides, your problem's not each other, your problem's the City of London. Why aren't you attacking the City of London, the Bank of England? Go to the source of your real problems. I never get a reply. It's just, well, you must be a communist. Oh, you must be a fascist. Like Mom said, if you don't listen, son, you'll have to feel. If you want a copy of this big long article, I'll send it to you. I'll email it to you. But basically what I told you is that basically that's what it is. But it is sort of amusing that all the bad stuff that a lot of people say about the seeds and corn and Monsanto and their fertilizer and all that, if all that's being shipped to China, then I guess we don't have to go to war. They don't have to go to war with China. They're going to poison themselves out of existence like Americans. Sorry about the two parts for the show yesterday. I do that every once in a while, and I'm not good at editing. I'll screw up, and I'll get half a show, and then I'll have to do another half a show. So the webmaster put them together when we put the master up on the website, but you're in a hurry to get it, so you'll have a little problem there. You just have to open up them one at a time, in two halves. Yeah, I know. Hey, have any of you guys ever thought of starting the Anti-Semite Party of America and just flat out put it in their face? I mean, anti-Semite parties were very big in Europe, even prior to World War I. Very powerful groups of people, anti-Semite parties. And maybe someone's already done that. If so, I haven't heard about it. But what do you think, boys? That would really set the world on fire, man. I don't know whether you remember this story or not, but a guy by the name of Glendon Scott Crawford was a man with a dream. He wanted to build a mobile radioactive ray gun to kill Muslims in the U.S. Wow. Wow, man. That's something else. Anyhow, like I said, the one problem that the dream was with his dream was only people who offered to help him were FBI informants and undercover agents. Of course, they love this. They love it. They get wet dreams over this stuff. Crawford is currently being tried in federal court in New York State and faces at least 15 years if found guilty of terrorism charges for never even building the damn thing. He'd have been better off just with a regular old rifle. On Tuesday, the jury heard recordings of conversations between him and Chris Barker, the Imperial Wizards of the Loyal White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, and an informant who was taping the call. Oh, they wouldn't do something like that, would they? When you got a ray gun, you're going to kill all the Muslims? First, quote, the Mexican invasion, now the Muslim invasion. You got to remember the people who caused this invasion. It's the U.S. government itself. It's the State Department. It's all those people. That's why all these other people are here. That's why the Muslims and the Mexicans are here. Your government wants them here. If they didn't want them here, they wouldn't be here. So why don't you use your ray gun on somebody that's important? Crawford tells Barker on the tape, Barker's the FBI informant, as the Albany Times-Union reported, quote, technology is such that you can build a device and put it in a van. A couple of clans, a couple of chapters would have to get together and work this thing out. Barker, as this newspaper previously reported, is a rogue white supremacist with a long record that includes multiple DUI charges, numerous arrests for violence, and such a loathsome reputation that even other Klansmen regularly denounce him. In fact, Barker was a key suspect in a 2011 defacing of a church. Oh my God. An incident that led him to getting kicked out of one Klan group. Yet the North Carolina man was a key component of an FBI investigation into Crawford. A complex operation that shows the drastic lengths the authorities will go to bring terrorism charges. even when their targets have little chance of following through on their hopeless plans without the financing prompted and encouragement of the FBI. Yeah, you want to be a terrorist, you got to go to the FBI to get your financing first. Got that? According to Crawford's defense attorney, the 51-year-old wasn't anywhere near creating the fantastical weapon of his dreams. All he had was a piece of paper and an idea. I thought it took three parts to make a crime. The coming together, the meeting of the minds, the agreement, the putting it together, and then going to fulfill the operation. Crawford's alleged accomplice, Eric Fate, pled guilty in 2014 to providing material support of terrorism. Federal agents have acknowledged in court that they didn't know whether Crawford was serious about his outlandish scheme at first. Oh, Christ, you knew that. If not, you're dumber than he was. And in any case, experts have said that the ray gun would have been impractical, even had it been constructed. Well, then why didn't you just forget about it? Still, undercover FBI operatives kept stringing Crawford along, offering to buy him equipment so he would be continued to corresponding with them. Wow. When asked by Crawford's lawyer whether the FBI encouraged Crawford to commit a crime, an agent answered, quote, I don't think encourage is the right word. We would allow him to do that, unquote. See, that's why the FBI and ATF and all these people endanger the public at large, because you never know for sure when one of these operations might go wrong and the guy might actually accomplish his goal. The authorities had been watching the would-be supervillain since 2012, when he approached the Israeli embassy in New York City, showed up at a synagogue and Jewish community center, and called his congressman asking for support for his plan to build a deadly X-ray device. Boy, that's something else. He calls his congressman. Oh, put him in the rubber room. All contacted law enforcement. Later that year, he reached out to Barker, the ex-Klansman informant, with the idea that the KKK leader could help him out. Crawford emailed Barker, unbeknownst to the government, according to the FBI, and the two began to collaborate. Barker became so involved that on July 27, 2012, Crawford told an undercover FBI agent he was in contact with to call Barker, according to emails obtained by this newspaper. The Knights, Barker's group, may have the resources to invest and bring the project to fulfillment, wrote Crawford. Then on August 7th, Barker was arrested for unrelated federal charges of possession of a firearm by a convicted felon. This was an FBI informant. According to Forsyth County, North Carolina, law enforcement officials and sources close to the investigation against Crawford. Wow, man. 3 days after he was arrested, he told the cops about Crawford's scheme. While sitting in a can on August 10th, he called the FBI and sold the government this ridiculous story about how he had information of a plot with enough explosives in New Jersey to blow up New Jersey and New York together, said one source familiar with the case against Crawford. Boy, his nose gets longer as he goes along. On August 13, the same day, he was released from federal custody. Barker, while wired up by the FBI, placed a call to Crawford and invited him down to North Carolina, according to the criminal complaint filed by the FBI special agent. They're all special agents. Godfrey Kent, Crawford made this tip, quote, unsolicited and without any government role or direction, unquote. They didn't encourage me to do nothing. I just wanted to do it. The two men met while Barker was wearing a wire. Here again, strip them down, check them out. Everything went well. Hope things are good on your end. Great plan. Barker emailed Crawford on August 28. Would love to see this once great nation in our hands again. Back in the hands of white Christian Americans. Why not just white Americans? Like our founding fathers planned it to be. Well, forget them. They've been dead a long time. They get a lot of lip service, but that's about it. Take care, brother. Keep in touch. Hail victory. Well, that's Aryan Nations. In the following weeks, Barker recorded multiple conversations with Crawford and then arranged for Crawford to meet with two men he said were wealthy KKK members. I never found any in my group, wealthy KKK members, who wanted to finance the nuclear weapons plot, but in fact were undercover FBI agents. In the following months, the agents provided cash, bought components, and even constructed a fake terror device, according to court documents. Aren't these FBI guys very creative? They're really creative. They're almost as stupid as the people they're after and the people they set up. No, FBI can't be stupid, no. Seems to me a couple of buildings fell down because their incompetence. Barker's apparently remains in the FBI's good graces, even though he is a chief suspect in painting a swastika on a synagogue in southeastern Virginia in July 2011. A hate crime has gone curiously unpursued, according to local and federal law enforcement, KKK members, and the synagogue officials. Well, I thought that was just a misdemeanor. But now, I guess, painting a synagogue with a swastika? How about all the Jews that paint up synagogues with a swastika? I don't think I've ever seen one indicted or taken to trial. They do it all the time. On that Independence Day weekend, four members of the rebel brigades of the Ku Klux Klan attended a cross burning in rural southeastern Virginia, got drunk, drove to Danville, and desecrated the Beth Shalom Synagogue by painting a swastika on the front door. What have I got to tell? I got to tell you guys over and over, the synagogue is the banks, the federal banks, state banks, central banks. That was a synagogue. You want to paint synagogues up with swastikas? Well, start with the banks. Because that's where the Jew money's at, along with the corrupt, predatory capitalist Aryans' money. Danville residents placed an American flag to obscure the vandalism. Oh, my God. And local police opened a criminal investigation. We got to find out where that paint come from. The FBI was notified immediately that a hate crime had occurred. That term hate crime is so ludicrous. I don't ever remember hearing about any love crimes. When's a love crime? I never had a love crime committed against me. I've had a lot of hateful things done to me. Chris Barker, who was an informant, Klansman, has been very high on the list of suspects for the synagogue incident since the get-go. Oh, my God. They're going to get him, said Danville Police Chief Philip Broadfoot in an interview in July. You realize how funny and silly that all this bullshit is and cops running all over the place trying to find somebody that painted a synagogue up? Oh, jeez. It's hilarious. It's hilarious. Multiple Klan officials, others with knowledge of events of that night, and four law enforcement officials who were making lots of money, paid high wages, confirmed to this magazine that Barker was the ringleader behind the hateful vandalism. 2 months after the incident, one of those who committed the crime confessed to the rebel brigades of the Ku Klux Klan Imperial Wizard and named the people responsible. The KKK group promptly expelled the four members, including FBI informant Barker and his wife. Quote, You do not deface houses of worship, never mind control centers. You never touch those places. Because that's where we really fuck up the people's minds. That's why they don't want them. Don't screw with the churches. Don't screw with the synagogues. Because that's where the real brainwashing bullshit goes on. We kicked them out in the third week of September, 2011, when we found out Chris Barker gives the Klan a bad black eye. People would love us if we didn't have people like that in our Klan. They told us so down at the Bar and Grill. No one's been arrested for the crime, even though they spent $50,000 trying to find out who did it. Though in July 2015, the FBI listed the case's investigation closed, according to public records. That's because they're covering the ass of an informant. Just like Barry Rowe, who put a bullet through the head of Viola LaRusso, the Freedom Rider girl, and they're not going to take anybody to the trial that's working their side of the street. No one has been arrested for the crime. I said that before. Members of the congregation remain upset about the lack of communication on the part of the feds. The FBI did send a document to the synagogue on March 6, 2013, but it said a criminal investigation can be a lengthy undertaking, and for several reasons, we cannot tell you about its progress at this time. One of the reasons is we don't know what the fuck we're doing. If the FBI, they're waiting on an informant. The only way they'll ever make an arrest in these cases is an informant. Somebody's got a rat. Somebody's got a squeal. And usually the FBI has to pay somebody off. If the FBI told me we can't do anything with it, but I can't tell you why, as a taxpayer, I would find that less objectionable than what appears to be the case that the evidence is being ignored, said Peter Howard, longtime leader of Beth Shalom. How much patience should I have before I conclude I'm being ignored? Oh, God. More fun than a barrel of monkeys. Barrel of niggers. Detailed messages about the 2011 incident were left with several different FBI agencies, but went unreturned. It seemed clear that in the years since the swastika case, Barker, FBI informant, has become valuable to the Bureau, even if no one else shares the Fed's high opinion of him. Your mother may like you, Barker, but Jesus hates your guts. God said you should always find something good in someone. But I don't think God has ever met Chris Barker, said Snuffer. Yeah. Well, there's a case that's cost a fortune trying to figure it out. Yeah. All these FBI, I paid FBI guys running around looking for the bad guy who painted a synagogue up with a swastika. He should be ashamed of himself. Well, I think old Scott Walker's got his tits in a ringer. Both tits. Campaigning in New Hampshire. Oh, there, I forgot to turn off my damn. Back to Scott Walker, campaigning in New Hampshire, where he finds himself tied in the polls with also ran's Carly Florina, Mike Huckabee. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker labeled questions as to whether he would meet with Black Lives Matter activists, I call them black terrorists, as ridiculous, reports the Daily Mail. With his campaign so floundering in neighboring Iowa, where he once polled in the double figures, Walker has become more aggressive as of late, echoing many of the same talking points that have boosted blustery businessman Donald Trump to the lead in the 2016 GOP presidential campaign. Oh, that's GOP. Asked at a Politics and Eggs breakfast forum in Manchester on Friday if he would take some time to sit down with the African-American activists, in other words, the niggers, Walker called the question ridiculous. quote, I'm going to meet with voters. I mean, I've said it's not just who knows who that is. The flustered Walker replied before comparing the grassroots civil rights organization to the Tea Party. Wait a minute here. This is funny. This gets funnier all the time. Let's see here. I'm here to talk to voters in New Hampshire about things that matter, Walker told the Daily Mail. While Black Lives Matter niggers have made inroads by the meeting with 2016 Democratic presidential candidates, there's been little outreach from the GOP campaign to the black community. Trump threatens to have the protesters beat up, and now Walker is dismissing them outright. During a recent appearance on the Iowa State Fair, at the Iowa State Fair, Walker ignored the questions and commented from Black Lives Matter protesters who were bussed in for his political event. According to Wisconsin constituent and BLM activist Clara Fox of Milwaukee, Walker refused to take even one question from a black member of the audience. Whoa! While speaking in Iowa, Walker used his unwillingness to meet with concerned but opposing groups as a badge of courage. Quote, you want someone who's tested? I'm right here. You can see it. This is what happened in Wisconsin. We will not back down, unquote, he told the crowd. Well, well, what's going on here, man? There seems to be a little change in the weather. I love it. I love it. Well, here's another good story. How about that? The State Bar of Michigan has discontinued its annual short story writing contest for legal professionals after being hit hard with criticism for honoring a story by a white supremacist that was nothing less than a racist revenge fantasy about murdering a black nigger prisoner. Oh! According to the Associated Press, the bar has issued an apology. We're sorry we offended the niggers. And withdrawn an award for the story. Well, of course. Post-conviction relief by Kyle Bristow, an attorney listed by the Southern Poverty Law Center as being a notorious racist and former member of a hate group. Bristow, author of White Apocalypse, submitted a story to the contest run by the state bar for budding Scott Turow's or John Grisham's to show off their literary chops. While state bar chairwoman Francine Cullery said the judges considered Bristow's writings to be an imaginative work of fiction rather than a potential ideological manifesto. The bar later admitted they failed to recognize the underlying symbolism of this story. Wow. Underlying symbolism aside, the story is quite flagrant in using stereotypes. We all know niggers aren't niggers. They're chocolate-colored white people, including an 18-year-old tattoo-covered drug-abusing gangbanger named Tyrone Washington, which constitutes half of the ghetto. 18-year-old tattooed-covered drug-abusing gangbanger named Tyrone Washington. I said that before. What's the matter with you, stupid? Who murders a 16-year-old girl named Caroline. Well, that happens quite a bit, doesn't it? Are you trying to say, that never happens, niggers never do things like that? The girl's mother then dies from a heart attack as a result of her grief, and the father, formerly a liberal attorney, murders Washington in a prison conference room after delivering an extended soliloquy on justice, Kant, retribution, and would make Ayn Rand laugh. Well, that's cool. That's good. In fact, that's the way it should be handled. If my daughter was murdered by a Negro anthropoid, I think I'd figure a way out, a way to get his ass. Well, it is notable that the Michigan Bar apologized for honoring the story. Oh, my God, we can't do that. They have yet to explain why such a laughable and poorly written story was lauded at all. Well, we all know how horrible it was. They insulted a Negro gangbanger. Here's a sampling, and a fictional one at that. Here's a sampling of the post-conviction relief passages so you can judge for yourself. Before attending law school, he had graduated with a degree in philosophy from the University of Michigan, and he has spent much of his time during his legal career safeguarding the rights of people who had been charged with crimes. As an attorney and a self-styled armchair philosopher who read classical texts of Western civilization as a hobby, Jack knew better than most why due process and ordered liberty are sacrosanct to the human experience, and he was well aware of his oath as an officer of the court. But now Jack Schoenherr could care less about his ethical obligations, the law, or his former philosophical musings about the purpose of justice being about the rehabilitation of his clients, because his only child, 16-year-old Caroline, was murdered by an 18-year-old anthropoid ape, tattoo-covered, drug-abusing gangbanger named Tyrone Washington a year and a half ago to the day, and since then Jack's wife, Claire, had passed away due to heart failure. The doctors at the hospital had told him that his daughter's murder had caused his wife to lose weight and suffer stress in such an extent that it simply broke her heart. I can understand. It was a cold, wintry day, which is typical of the Michigan in February, and the sky was white and hazy and overcast. The wind was blowing calmly from the west, and the snow cracked under Jack's black shoes as he walked toward the main entrance. He looked no different than the other lawyers, sheriff's deputies, and civilians milling around, except for the look of fury contained within his blue eyes, which were now focused forward like laser beams. Until, upon entering the elevator, Jack silently congratulated himself on the plan he had formulated. He wanted the thug, nigger, who murdered his daughter to die and was here to do the deed himself. Although he was once a relatively politically progressive and boasted of his prosecutor friends at the Bar Association functions, that he took immense pride in the fact that Michigan was the first English-speaking government in the world to abolish the death penalty for crimes, excluding treason, and never executing a person since becoming a state in 1837. Maybe that's why they have such a bad high crime rate. His purpose on earth now was consumed with the meting out of the death penalty to one person, nay, one animal, who called the Macon County Jail his home. Wow. This is getting good. Jack, sitting straight up in a chair with an aura of intent about him, pondered his situation as he stared at Tyrone Washington. Could there be one more stark contrast between him and me? I worked hard all my life to go through undergraduate and law school. I worked hard to pay back my student loan debt and provide for my family. I played by the rules in everything I did. I never hurt anyone. He, on the other hand, never worked a day in his life. He stopped going to school after the sixth grade. He was a leech on law-abiding citizens whom he committed crimes, and he offends everything of which he has dealings. Even the tattoos on his body, especially the thug one on his forehead, constitute a manifestation of his repugnant nature. Well, this guy sure ain't a liberal. Tyrone drooled and snorted as he slouched further in his chair as Jack continued his lecture. Philosophically, a lot of people are under the impression that the purpose of criminal justice is to rehabilitate offenders. But this is a misconception, because if rehabilitation was the goal, then a person who does no actual wrong but who is philosophically deviant from the spirit of the age could be penalized, which would be offensive to natural law. While at the same time, if a person does something absolutely monstrous, but wakes up the next day after finding Jesus or Muhammad, or appearing to appreciate right and wrong and being able to act accordingly, then could not be subjected to punitive measures, which would be offensive to society and the victims, and his would prevent people from guiding their actions by positive law after they recognize the lack of real ramifications for their actions, unquote. Tyrone stared at the ceiling of the conference room. Utter boredom palpably afflicted him. Retributionism is the only legitimate basis for justice, because though retributionism, good is rewarded with good and bad is punished with bad. This is the purpose of justice, after all, so says Aristotle in his Nicomachean Ethics. What's this got to do with my appeal, bro? Tyrone asked. I don't want to be in the slammer for life, man. An appeal, Jack laughed as he walked around the table in which Tyrone handcuffed sat. My learned thoughts lost him. Gripping his metal pen with strategically sharpened tip that deputies did not notice in his fist, Jack quipped, I'm not here for an appeal. I'm here for my post-conviction relief following a trial. After Jack acquired the relief of the Michigan justice system, could not deliver and has not delivered since its statehood, he sat down in the chair across from the slumped-over, bloodied body of the convicted nigger murderer who had crudely taken his daughter's life for the thrill of it. I rest my case, Jack decreed. The entire story, if haven't had enough, can be read here. So you can get the story. I'll try to send it out to you because, see, this is so truthful, so to the point, that they can't stand it. It drives them up the fucking walls. And it's absolute, that stuff happens all the time, except the guy going into the prison and knifing the guy with a ballpoint pen. Yeah, I think he saw that on The Godfather. I love it, baby. I love it. Yeah. They should make a movie out of that. Well, here we go again. Ted Cruz. Senator Ted Cruz, Republican of Texas, appeared Friday morning on a radio program hosted by an Iowa conservative who suggested that illegal aliens should be pressed into slavery. Well, I know that the Republicans like that idea. The Republican presidential candidate questioned whether there was a constitutional right to birthright citizenship, which is spelled out in the 14th Amendment. Incidentally, the 14th Amendment is not legal, never was legal. It's only legal by fiat, because it did not have the proper show up of people and congressmen and so forth to be passed. Check it out. There's a lot of stuff on that. 14th Amendment's bullshit. During an appearance on Jan Michelson's radio show, reported Right Wing Watch. They're watching the right wing. Donald Trump, the Republican forerunner, said this week that some very good lawyers had told him that children born in the U.S. to illegal aliens were not actually citizens. Well, they're not. And Cruz himself, a Harvard-educated attorney, said the issue was a matter of debate. Quote, you know, it is open legal question whether changing the birthright citizenship could be done through a statute or could be done through a constitutional amendment. Cruz said, there's a serious constitutional scholars on both sides of the argument as a policy matter. But when it comes to race, Tom Metzger says there's no argument at all. I think it is a basic common sense that we shouldn't be incentivized. What the hell word is that? Illegal immigration. That it doesn't make sense to provide rewards for people to break the law and come here. Any more than if we went down there and did it. I mean, what the hell's the matter with you people? I've been fighting this thing since, whoa, God. I've lost count. 20, 30 years? 35 years? I don't know. It's been a long time. I used to talk and have coffee with a lot of immigration officers, and they all told me it was illegal for these anchor babies, that they weren't citizens. Yeah. They knew it, but the higher-ups were overlooking it. I knew a lot of immigration officers that quit in disgust and said to hell with it.
Of Donald Trump's being in this race is it's forced the mainstream media to talk about illegal immigration.
Right.
They don't want to talk about it, And that is very beneficial. And I think what's happening is when voters start looking at this issue, they then start asking, okay, who has a record? Who's actually been fighting on this? And for years, I've been leading the fight, actually standing shoulder to shoulder with Steve King. So, you know, one of the striking things a couple of weeks ago at that debate in Cleveland, of the 10 candidates standing on that stage, a majority of the Republicans on that stage have previously supported amnesty. There is a sharp difference. And in contrast, I have never supported amnesty, and I have always led the fight against amnesty. So, for example, when Chuck Schumer and Harry Reid and the Democrats joined with establishment Republicans in trying to push through a massive amnesty program that I would note quite a few of the folks on that debate stage supported, I stood with Jeff Sessions in the Senate and Steve King in the House, and we led the fight and defeated amnesty in the United States Congress. And that, I believe, is why we're seeing such an incredible surge of support. So many people across the country going to TedCruz.org, signing up to volunteer, contributing online, because people are fed up.
Okay, yada, 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 yeah, right. Okay, Cruz, you got your point in. Not going to change much, though, because, well, you know why. You know why, boys and girls. Because the man wants it this way. The man wants it this way. Well, this is a good one. The IRS is getting pressured who begin cracking down on televangelists. Following a John Oliver segment on HBO last week that I played yesterday, Oliver blasted televangelists this past Sunday for what he called seed faith, where they tell donors they will reap the rewards of giving money to them. I remember there was a Reverend Ike years ago, another nigger, that was doing that, made a fortune off this prosperity Christianity crap. They preach something called the prosperity gospel, which argues that wealth is a sign that God's favor and donations will result in wealth coming back to you, like a boomerang. That idea sometimes takes the form of seed faith. The notion that donations are seeds that you will one day get to harvest. Well, anyhow, the IRS is getting a lot of pressure. It's time for you to give them pressure, too. Pressure the IRS. Go after these churches. They're robbing the people blind. I mean, all of them are, really. Not just a few. More of these frackers that are destroying land all over the United States and destroying... destroying water sources and... water aquifers. Top shale oil producers. Pioneer Natural Resources and Company, PXDN, was found an unusual way to save water and cut costs for its wells, tapping the treated runoff from toilets, sinks, and showers in West Texas. Pioneer has signed an 11-year, $117 million deal with the city of Odessa, Texas, that will guarantee its access to millions of gallons of treated municipal wastewater each day for the use in nearby oil fields. Deliveries of the so-called effluent are expected to start at the end of the year. That's wonderful. It's still a shit way to operate. As crude oil has slid to its lowest level in 6 years, they don't make money on fracking. They do not make money on fracking. That's what people don't seem to realize. But they do get loans, and then they default on the loans, so they do make money. Currently, it's about $40 a barrel. Oil and gas companies pumping from shale rock have tried to cut every unnecessary penny from their operations. Water acquisition and transportation can be up to 10% of the cost of drilling and fracking a well, according to the consulting firm IHS. Well, these guys go in, they pump the hell out of an area, and then they leave, and most of them go broke, and they file for bankruptcy, and they leave all their crap, and the hole in the ground makes the place look terrible. It's horrible for the environment. Producers are also trying to mitigate long-term risks of water scarcity in the arid Permian Basin of West Texas, where the top U.S. oil field is situated. Oil and gas companies operating in the area, including Pioneer and Apache Corporation, have long sought cheaper, more environmentally sound sources of water to use for fracking. Of course, fracking takes a hell of a lot of water to do, and we should outlaw it totally. Totally outlaw that stuff, you know. During hydraulic fracking, millions of gallons of water are blasted along with sand and chemicals into the earth, into a well drilled through shale and other rocks, replacing good water with shit water. The high-pressure slurry cracks the rock, allowing oil and gas to escape and exit the well. As I said, it should be outlawed, period. More and more, of course, of this oil that they're getting up is transferring over to all the millions of illegal aliens, millions of Mexicans that have come into this country, and blacks from other countries in the Caribbean, and people from all over the world coming here, and they all want to drive around in cars. We don't need that. We don't need them coming, and we don't need the fracking, and we don't need more oil. Stop it. Before we stop it for you. Well, that's it, boys and girls. I'll be back with you on Moon's Day. Yeah, get my 2 days this week to do a lot of other things around this bunker that need to be done. Sayonara.
The Flint River is such...
Last time I heard this show, I was backstage, and I was out front, and God... I hated to follow it after seeing it all. And loved everybody's version of all those songs. I don't... Baby, you remember me writing that Vieta Chili song? Some of these... I mean, it was good and all that, but I just... Some of these things slip your mind. You know, when I was a young man, growing up, I had a hero, and of course he was a guitar picker. A lot of people hear this song and think he was an old guy, but he's about 18 or 19 years old, and I was about 7 or 8 years old, and he tells stories about working up in Ohio. This was after the Second World War, and all these soldiers came home and America was celebrating and drinking a lot of beer, and he worked in those beer joints up in Ohio. And he told me a story one time. He said, "Young man, you should have seen me when I was up there in Ohio with that 5-piece band." And I'm sitting there and my eyes are... He said, "We all had shirts just alike." And I was thinking, I didn't know they made 5 shirts just alike, but I would have loved to have been in that band. But he, and I've had a lot of great fortune in my life, and one of them is writing songs, and I thought about this song for about a year, and I said, you know, thinking about how I got to Nashville and made a living making up songs, and I said, I want to pay a tribute to the fellow who inspired me to be a guitar picker and a singer. So I wrote this song and been able to share it with people just about all over the world. I'll sing it for you folks. I remember the year that Clayton Delaney died. They said for the last 2 weeks that he suffered and cried. It made a big impression on me, although I was a barefoot kid. They said he got religion at the end, and I'm glad that he did. You know, Clayton was the best guitar picker in our town. I thought thought he was a hero, and I used to follow Peyton around. Peyton used to tell me, son, you better put that old guitar away. There ain't no money in it, it'll lead you to an early grave. But Daddy said he drank a lot, but I could never understand. I knew he used to pick up in Ohio with a five-piece band. And I often wondered why Clayton, who seemed so good to me, never took his guitar, made it down in Tennessee. Well, I guess if I'd admit it, Clayton taught me how to drink food. But I can see him half-stoned to picking out the lovesick blues. When Clayton died, I made him a promise I was gonna carry on somehow. I'd give $100 if he could only see me now. But I remember the year that Clayton Delaney died. Nobody ever knew it, but I went out in the woods and I cried. There's a lot of big preachers, and they know a lot more than I do. Could be that the good Lord likes a little picking too. Oh, I hope so. I remember the year.